Hey, folks, Chef Craig, you're listening to Chew the Fat. We're the podcast where you can listen to very successful chefs, food personalities, winemakers, cheesemakers, food artisans. Find out what's behind their passion. Find out what drives them, what makes them stay up late, get up early, and have the great love for what they do. So without further ado, tonight we have Levi Mezick, Chef Levi Mezick, who started in the kitchens of, I'm not even going to tell you the name of the restaurant, but I remember him from Clifton Inn when he was just out of high school. He worked around Charlottesville, Virginia, and the rest is history, which we'll learn about tonight. He's worked for some of the best chefs in the world, and now he's on his own. He has his own kitchen, and he's rocking and rolling in Monterey, California. Levi, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. So, Levi, I know we talk every once in a while and everything, but real quick, tell me about your family. Your wife, children, you know, what's happening out there?
We left New York City, and then we went to D.C. We were there for a quick bit, and then we came out to Monterey, and my wife and my 4-year-old son came with me. Sometimes my 4-year-old son is a little more I can handle, but he's doing really well, and yeah, he's a lot of fun.
Do you know, it's probably payback, you know?
It's totally payback. It's my mother. My mother and my father tell me that all the time. This is the way you were, now you have to deal with it. It's awesome.
I think I was talking to you a little earlier, but I think you probably were a little spoiled when you were younger, from when I first remember you back when you were like 18. You know,
I don't know. I mean, I had all the prep school stuff. I mean, we didn't have a lot of money growing up, but my grandfather sent me to a private school, so that might have rubbed off on me a little bit.
Yeah.
I remember when I walked in with my long hair, walked in to Clifton the Country Inn, and I was working for Edward at the Schnitzel House.
That's the name of the restaurant. I forgot. The Schnitzel House.
The Schnitzel House. Oh, he's even there. He's not even there anymore. He retired and went back to Germany.
No, it's now Carmelo's.
Yeah. Anyway, I walked in with my long hair all the way down to my chin. I looked at you and I told you I was a cook. And you looked at me and you told me I was a dishwasher. That's kind of the way it started. You're like, you start at 6. Yeah. I said, a.m.? And you said, yes, a.m.
Yeah, I remember that. You know what the main thing I remember, though, from Clifton is the time you passed out when you saw blood on your fingertip. Have you gotten over?
Oh, yeah, you grabbed my fingertip, and you yanked me, and you pulled me across the kitchen to the sink.
That's irrelevant.
And said, this is what a chef is. This is what you have to deal with. Cut yourself. Get over it. Tape it up. Go back to work.
Well, you couldn't because you fell over and, knocked me down. But have you gotten over that?
I remember when I cut myself, and I had to get, 12 stitches?
Yeah.
I was rocking a knife on the cookie dough.
Yeah.
And I opened the whole thing up. And I looked at it, and I was like, oh, man, that's kind of bad. I look around, and Debbie had left the kitchen, and you weren't even there. You were in the office.
Yeah, true.
I walked over to you, and I was like, I cut myself. And you're like, yeah, yeah. And I was like, no, really? And I moved my fingers, and the whole thing opened up. And you're like, yeah, you actually cut yourself this time.
Yeah, yeah. And then, boom, lights out. But that was cool. So, look, you know, I think one of the things that's real interesting about your story is that, well, you cultivated your career very carefully, but at the same time, I'm not sure you had it. You had like a plan when you were back with me, and then you went with John at OXXO and other places. Did you have a plan? Were you like saying, okay, I'm going to go to France, and after that, I'm going to New York City, or did it just unfold?
I mean, after I left you, I went to culinary school, and I went there, and I was lucky enough to go to a Berge, and that showed me something.
Right.
And then I guess I came back when I first started working at Keswick again, and I saw a large brigade system,
right,
and a very focused brigade, and a very European brigade.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of taught me what the kitchen could be.
Right.
And then my wife, of course, is French, so she gave me the ability to kind of travel around the world and work in some of those places. And that kind of just, I mean, it showed me what you could really do.
Yeah,
with cuisine and how far you could really take it.
Yeah, true. So let me ask you, did you go to New England Culinary?
Yeah, I went to New England Culinary.
Yeah, right.
Even though you were desperate for me to go to CIA. I remember that.
It was a little upsetting, but, you know, I got over it. So you went to New England Culinary, And when you got out, when did you end up going to France, or, and how did you meet your wife? Did you meet her before you
met? I met my wife at Keswick Hall.
No kidding.
She was on a J-1 visa. And then she went. Her visa ended. And I always wanted to go to Europe, so I convinced her it was a good idea to go work in Italy. And I tried desperately to get a visa. And I just I just kept going back and forth. I mean, I kept running out of money.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd fly back, and John would, thankfully, at OXXO, take me back and let me work there for a while longer. And I'd save up money again, and then I'd fly back to France, and I'd live there for a little bit longer. I'd fly back to OXXO and make some more money. It's kind of like every time I'd leave in the summer during the off season.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'd come back in the winter when he was busy. So,
let me ask you. So, there's two real interesting things. John from OXXO. Explain your time with him and like what you learned with John.
I think John was the first real permanent line cook position I had. When I worked at Auberge du Soleil in Napa Valley, I was on the line as an extern. I worked my way on the line. That was the only time he'd ever had an extern that actually made it to the hotline at night. And that gave me some experience, but it was only for a few months.
Right.
And it was a large brigade. And I was young, and the sous chef thought I was, entertaining. So they used to really help me out a lot.
Yeah, good.
I wouldn't have made it without the sous.
Yeah.
And without, there was a guy who worked there named Chad, and he worked saute in the AM.
Right.
And he'd been a sous chef at some very prestigious places.
Yeah.
And I knew, and he helped me out. He taught me. He taught me how to be a line cook.
Right.
Because I'd never really had a lot of line experience.
Sure.
At Clifton, it wasn't really a line experience.
No.
Kind of the same style.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I came back and working with John. It kind of just finished everything off. John really just kind of let us go, which I guess it was kind of a double-edged sword for both parties. But, he was amazingly encouraging, and we got to play with different things and different specials, and we really got to expand our horizon. It was a great team. All the team that was there has really gone on. There's a lot of them are still in Charlottesville, but all of them have gone on to do some pretty cool things. Tucker now is the chef of Clifton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we interviewed Tucker, and he's a real interesting guy, and he's doing some pretty cool food over at Clifton. I've been following his blog, and his food looks great.
Yeah, he's a really cool blog. I like his blog.
Yeah. But John is one of my favorite people. I actually performed his wedding ceremony. And and that was one of the most successful wedding unions of all time, wasn't it?
Uh-huh.
Don't say anything. We're live on the thing.
John was great. John was also, he was a chef that was completely hands-on. If John was there, John worked the meat station.
Yeah.
And pretty much I worked the fish station, and Tucker worked hot apps, and Jason was holding down pastries. And that was, for a long time, that was the team. Some people came in and out and gave John days off or gave us days off. Like Corey.
Right.
And some other people. We always had a interesting mix of people coming from different restaurants that would always be coming through that place. But John was impressive. He held down that kitchen really, really tight and really well.
True enough. I had some of my best memory meals with John. And when he was at Keswick, when I was at Clifton and ate there, and he was kind of the chef de cuisine. The food was always really good. But he was kind of a madman. Would you call him a madman?
Yeah, he was a little bit of a madman. I think he was a big inspiration for me to go to New York.
Yeah.
Because he always talked about Danielle. He'd always tell me the stories of when he first came over, and he worked at Restaurant Danielle when it was in the original space, which is now Cafe Bleu.
Right.
It was great. He definitely, all those stories really made me think about New York. In no uncertain terms, it was always the reputation of if you want to go and you want to really cook and you want to see how far you can really push it and how fast you can really go to New York.
So when you got out of chef school, were you thinking in your head, I definitely want to get some experience in France and Italy and stuff, or did that just happen being at Keswick and you met your wife?
When I was in chef school, I always wanted to go to Europe. I didn't know how I'd get it done. And I always wanted to work in... you always, when I was going to chef school, I remember it was the first time they'd ever really published the Best Restaurant in the United States award.
Right.
That everybody took pretty seriously, and
sure.
The French Laundry won it for that year. And that, those kind of things started to really inspire us to, you know, that you could really take your career and go to a certain, to go to, I mean, a different level with it.
Yeah, right. So now, this is pretty cool, though. You met your wife at Keswick. She was on a J-1 visa. So this is like a love story born at Keswick Hall.
Yeah.
I think I should roll with this. I'm going to have to send something over to Keswick and tell them all about this. Maybe they'll, you know, maybe they'll give you like a week there or something, and, you know, maybe a reality TV show.
But I don't know about the reality TV show.
You know, while I was there, there were several J-1s that ended up getting married. So I think I didn't realize that's how you met her. That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. Well, you know, Keswick, this year and last year on Condé Nast Traveler got the highest award for food of any hotel, over top of L'Auberge and in at Little Washington, White Barn, Home Hill, The Ranch, all those places. So 98.7. And then I quit. But anyway, so I'm a barbecue guy now. I don't know if I told you that, but.
Yeah, read your tweets, man. Your tweets are cool.
Yeah, we had, you know, if you get any ideas for some good pigisms, we call them pigisms, let us know. We are making a new sandwich called Hell, which is, I think it's going to have like fried mac and cheese and then some like, pig skins that are tossed in ghost pepper sauce and some other stuff. I got this idea. It's coming. But so, Levi, when you went with your wife to France, how did you find jobs there? Did you just walk up to places, knock on the door? Did you make calls? I mean,
in Italy, when we found that job, we just sent letters. And we sent letters. I mean, I pretty much blanketed the country.
Sure.
Just sending letters and sending letters. And then... Well, I also got hooked up with, when I was in New York, the chef over there sent me a letter in French basically typed me a letter in French, and I did the same thing. I sent it to every possible restaurant that I could get an address for. I just sent them a letter.
Right.
And I just kept sending them until I got a response.
And
postage,
so,
which is crazy, but
and so when they respond to you, do they say, you know, okay, you're going to show on, you know, January 1st at 2:00, and then you just got to be
there. I mean, when I went to Lumeron, I didn't really understand how far out Lumeron was, but it was pretty far out there. It was in the sticks. And I mean, they have a room for you, and you just kind of stay in that room, and you just wake up at 6:00 in the morning, you go to work, and you take a break around 3:00 and like a little siesta.
Yeah.
Usually you sleep, and then you go back in and you work till 12:30, 1:00 in the morning.
Nice. So, how did they treat you when you first got into the kitchens?
Were you speaking
French at the time, or?
I mean, a little bit, but not enough. I mean, I think that was my biggest, that was definitely my biggest hardship is that, you know, right. I didn't fully speak the language. And that was always, you know, a little bit of a drag.
Mm-hmm.
Just try to keep up, especially in the middle of service, because, I mean, people speak so quickly.
Yeah,
it's
true
really,
enough.
I mean, it's hard for people to understand English, let alone, you know, trying to keep two different languages straight at the same time and hold down a section.
Yeah. For sure. So you actually got a section when you were in France? They didn't just have peeling onions?
No, I mean, usually I'd take the garmage, I'd do some prep, or, you know, I very rarely got a full-on section.
Uh-huh. And what do you think over there, what was like, especially France, and then we'll talk about Italy after, but what do you think was like the biggest influence on you from doing those stages?
I mean, just seeing, just seeing the structure, seeing the organization, I mean, seeing the different techniques that every restaurant would use, I think that was more it than anything else. But, I mean, to a certain extent, nowadays I find that in almost every restaurant they have pretty much their own operating procedures. And that's, you know, they're all built upon what whoever that chef and those people that have worked in that restaurant have seen. And they all bring their own little individual item or idea to those kitchens, and that's what builds up that restaurant.
Yeah, right.
So, I remember when I was in France, at Rue Louvet, you used to take pine cones and pine needles and put them in the bottom of a staub cassoulet and cook his lamb in there and then pull it out and light the whole thing on fire and send it out to the guests. So when you opened it, the smoke would come out, and that would pretty much perfume the dining room with the rosemary scent from the lamb, which was always kind of cool.
Yeah, I can imagine that. You know, I was thinking about doing something like that once, but I thought, you know, in America we have those... you know, those smoke alarms and everything. So.
Yeah. I mean, he had the smoke alarms, but the way his restaurant was shaped and It was in the Mediterranean, so sure. It was almost always warm. It was very rarely cold, and he would close during that 1 month that was cold.
Yeah.
So it was very open to the air. So nice. I mean, it cleaned it out quickly, because I've always thought about it, too. But I'm like, wow, closed dining room, and you pop two of those off. I mean, you got smoke everywhere. People would be choking on it. And you open the windows. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah, true enough. True enough. So, and then you were in Florence. Did you do one of your internships in Florence from out of school?
No, I ended up just going over there to work. And I ended up just going over there to work.
What was the name of that restaurant?
In Deca.
And it was, where was it located? I was just in Florence. I loved that city.
It's in the outside of Florence.
Yeah, we ate at a place called Il Quattro Leoni and had one of those giant Florentine steaks, but I didn't find any restaurants that had, like, super technique. I think I just ended up at all the tourist restaurants, so I should have talked to you first, you know?
When I was in Florence, I spent most of my time in Siena.
Did you?
My wife was living in Siena, and she was working at a little pizzeria off the Plaza de Campo,
mm-hmm.
Which I used to go in and have. I used to have dinners there when I wasn't working anywhere else, because they were very scared to have. And they wouldn't let me work in the kitchen. They were worried that immigration would come and that I would get caught, and then they would get a serious, serious fine. I mean, it was always. You came here, you ate, you know, if anyone comes, you must say that you came here, you ate yesterday.
Okay.
And we're letting you look.
Yeah.
You touch nothing.
Yeah.
Or just leave. They're like, or just leave.
Yeah, just get the hell out.
Well, I mean, pretty much, I mean, the fines over there would cost them their restaurant.
Wow.
It was pretty serious. It was really difficult. Italy was very, very difficult. I tried forever to get paperwork. And, place my wife was working actually tried to get me sponsored because mm-hmm. I wanted to go over there, and we both wanted to stay over there, but I could never get sponsored.
Yeah. Well, then here you are. So you came back, you went to New York City. How did you find jobs in New York City? I mean, there's a lot, you know, all these kids that are in chef schools. I mean, now in chef schools, I can't even imagine how many people are graduating every year, but it's got to be,
yeah.
It's got to be like 20, 30,000 people from some sort of a school, you know? And then they have to go try to compete for jobs.
Uh-huh.
What'd you do? How'd you find these jobs?
I begged.
So, I know.
I went to the New York Times, and I looked for different jobs, and then I just went around to every restaurant. I knocked on the door, and I pleaded to speak with the chef, or I called the restaurant, and I tried to talk to the chef. And New York is one of those unique cities where if you don't have any New York experience, it's very, very difficult to find a job.
Uh-huh.
And I had my sights set on a 3-star New York Times restaurant. You know,
sure.
I didn't want to work. I wanted to work at one of those restaurants. And
right.
Then finally I found a pastry intern position, like the pastry grunt,
uh-huh.
that they didn't have a student for some reason. And Troy over at Le Caravelle gave me the job.
Right.
And I made petit fours and stuff for a while. It was an interesting experience.
Sure.
It was definitely a lot different than anything else I'd done before. And in such a very large basement kitchen. I mean, it was a very, very large basement kitchen and an old kitchen. But, I mean, Troy was doing amazing food. I mean, he had just taken over Le Caravelle. I think he had just gotten finished with L'Espanasse in Washington, D.C., and he came back up and took on Le Caravelle.
What's his last name, Troy?
Troy Dupree.
Dupree. And so what's he doing now? Is he still there, Le Caravelle?
No, Le Caravelle closed down. I'm not sure. I was mainly with the pastry chef. I never really got too close to Troy or any of his people. And I only stayed, I believe, for about 6 months.
So now you did some stages, right? So, you know, to find jobs, like free tryouts, that type of thing?
Honestly, after Le Caravelle kept me kind of busy. I was there 6 to 7 days a week.
Right.
10 to 14 hours a day. And then...
That's not bad hours, right?
No,
six,
right.
7 days, 14 hours.
That's pretty quick. That's fast.
That's almost 100
and
hours.
Then I walked into Oceana. Again, I was just looking for stuff on the website.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff on New York Times. Now, I mean, I honestly go through Craigslist or even still the New York Times if I was in New York. And then I walked into Oceana, and Cornelius Gallagher had just taken over the kitchen.
Right.
He was the chef cuisine before, and they promoted him to executive chef, and I think it was his first week. I remember walking into his office and talking to him very, very briefly, and him being like, okay, you know, you can have it. And, you know, pretty much like, you don't really have that much New York experience. Good luck, kind of thing. You know, we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm going to make a lot of changes. You know, just be ready.
So he threw you in. Where did he throw you in? What was that job for?
Oh, he threw me into Entremet. I went right into Entremet. Well, actually, no. In the beginning, because he ripped apart the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, he ripped apart the kitchen. Him and his chef de cuisine, Christopher Lee, and Scotty Ekstrom, eventually, all went in there and they tore apart the whole kitchen with hacksaws one Sunday. They ripped out the refrigeration and they put in brand new refrigerator. I mean, they made it look a very, at that point, and now I look back on it, it was a very Alinea style kitchen.
Right.
The way they changed it, and they put everything on the side, and they put the, well, they couldn't put the pass, but they had the pass kind of in the middle.
Right.
But when I first took the job, I guess I was PM or AM fish saute. I was like, yeah, AM saute.
Yeah.
But then he ripped apart the whole kitchen. Then he had sauce, fish, veg, hot app, and garmage.
Nice.
I mean, for doing 200 plus covers for lunch,
mm-hmm.
and having one guy who cooks all the protein, it was, I mean, you were busy.
Yeah,
you were really
right.
Busy. It wasn't an easy place to work.
Well, and I understand he was pretty tough guy in the kitchen.
Yeah, I mean, he wanted to go somewhere. I mean, and he knew where he wanted to go. I mean, he worked for, when Boulay first got their four stars, he was there. And then at Peacock Alley, and then at L'Espinasse. And then when Danielle moved to the larger space and regained their four stars,
yeah,
he was at Boulay and Espinasse in Paris,
uh-huh.
or outside of Paris, somewhere in France. Yes, he wasn't, I mean, he wasn't the easiest. He knew what he wanted, and he knew where he wanted to go, and I would say that nothing was going to stand in his way.
Right.
And he achieved it. I mean, he maintained three stars. We got four stars, Washington Post. He got Food & Wine Best New Chef. He got Rising Star. I think he also got something with the James Beard, but I don't remember.
So how long was Christopher Lee his chef de cuisine?
Christopher Lee, he came over from John George. He
yeah.
was working at John George at the time. They had worked together. Pretty much the way the team ended up was Neil was a sous chef at Danielle, and then Christopher was his veg cook, and Scotty was his fish cook. And that was
That's
the
awesome.
Team that came over. He got Chris. Chris came right when we, before we redid the kitchen, there was another chef de cuisine there. I don't remember his name. We didn't really get along amazingly well. And then Chris came in. And Chris actually reminded me a lot of you, the way, you know, Chris was funny and loud. And
Did he hit you?
Smart and tense. No, he never hit me.
I'm just kidding.
No. Chris would never hit anybody.
Yeah. Well, he's a pretty cool guy. So is he still at Per Se, or is he?
Chris?
Yeah.
Chris now owns Huntington Social and Eden in Miami, Huntington Social in New Jersey and Eden, Miami.
Wow.
After he left, I mean, he was just recently the chef of Oriel in New York City.
Wow.
Yeah,
so it's pretty neat to see, you know, the progression, you know. So he was working at Danielle in Veg, and, you know, they worked their way up. And
if I had one thing I would tell culinary kids is when you start in a restaurant, I mean, one, if you think you're going to make money, then you should go do something else because you're not going to make money ever.
True
and
enough.
And then, you know, look at the people around you and understand that the people around you are going to be, if you're in a nice restaurant and they're focused on doing great food, those people will be the chefs. You know,
yeah.
All those people that you know now. I mean, a good example is when I was at Oceana, you know, Scotty was the executive sous chef for Michael Mina in San Francisco.
Right.
Chris Lee was the chef of Oriel in Manhattan. Melissa Rodriguez was their sous chef at Restaurant Danielle. Mike Davis is the chef de cuisine of Del Posto. Who else is the team? Carmichael is the executive pastry chef of Gilt Restaurant in Manhattan. Mikey is working in a restaurant. He's the chef of a restaurant down in Miami that I can't remember the name of. But you know, all of those people that you meet and you see and you work with, you know, later become the executive chefs of restaurants.
Right.
That, you know, if you are looking to, you know, go to a stage or go to eat, or, you know, I mean, like my friend Aaron, who I worked with at Cafe Blue, he was a sous chef with me, is now the executive chef of Blue Suit.
Yeah.
It just opened in Manhattan.
That's awesome.
I mean, it's just all those contacts you meet and you work with are the chefs of the next generation.
Yeah.
Just like what you're trying to be.
Right.
So, I mean, those relationships that you accumulate will pretty much last you for the rest of your life.
True enough.
And you'll utilize for the rest of your life.
True. So, look, you left Cornelius, and I know you worked your way up in Cornelius. I remember you once telling me a story how you would be, like, you know, entremetier, and, you know, Cornelius would fire the poissonnier and just be like, Levi, you're the poissonnier, or something like in the middle of service.
Well, me right. and a guy named Neil, another guy named Neil, who we actually called Lurch at the time, kind of stayed through the changeover of the kitchen. When
right.
we first had it, there were a lot of people that they weren't living up to, I guess, his expectations.
Right.
So when that happened and people didn't live up to expectations, he was fair. I mean, I would say he was firm but fair. You pretty much got three chances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, he would look at you and say, if you break this again, I'm going to fire you. And then they would do it again. He'd be like, okay. You know what I mean?
He'd yeah.
say, That's
yeah.
it. I'm sorry, but you did it again.
You got
to
go.
I asked you not to. You know, we've constantly had problems. So, I mean, for me, it was awesome because every time, maybe like, you know, I got to the point where it was just expected. I mean, I was staying on my friend's floor on an air mattress. I didn't really know anybody. I didn't really have a lot of money.
Yeah.
I had some debt to pay. So, I mean, every time Chris would just walk up to me, he's like, what's he doing? He's like, what are you doing? I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, tonight, what are you doing? I'm like, I got no plans, man. He's like, you want to work veg? I'm like, whatever. I'll go work veg. I was like, is it going to be set? Or I was like, I'm scraping by. I was like, so I still got some fish to cut. He's like, it'll be ready. I'm like, all right, cool, I'll do it. So, I mean, it just became like every time something happened or somebody didn't show up, Scotty or Chris would just come up to me and be like, what are you doing? I'd be like, hot apps.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yep.
You know, you see, that brings me.
And you could just see it. I'd be like, oh, yeah. This guy didn't show up, dude. I got to clean this stuff up.
Yeah, that brings me to a good point, Levi, and the point is that you went there to do that work so that you could set your career up,
yeah.
And you weren't thinking about what you were going to do after work or where you were going to go or who you were going to hang out with. It was all about the kitchen, and so, you know, when they asked you, you were ready to rock and roll. And you know what? I know from being a chef for years, if I had someone I could call on whenever I needed someone and they were there, that I knew that person was going to make it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's a big deal. That's huge, you know?
I mean, that's honestly, I believe that's how I got the sous chef position. I mean, I came back from France and I just rolled back into the kitchen. I was in Nîmes at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I was coming back from Nîmes and I just rolled back in the kitchen. I mean, I was just kind of coming back to Oceania to say, what's up? You know, I was going to go look for, you know, probably look for something else. I really want to come back and be a line cook at Oceana.
Sure.
I mean, not that anything was wrong with the cuisine. At that point, I'd already been there for 2 years, and, you know, I'd kind of done it, and I was like, you know. But I was just coming back to say hello to Neil and hello to Scotty and, you know, and hello to Chris and be like, do you guys know of anything? And then I remember I walked in, and I was like, what's up? And then Joey was there, and he was like, man, he didn't feel well, so... Chris is like, what? He's like, Levi, what are you doing? I'm like, what do you mean, dude? I haven't even been back yet. He's like, I don't even have my shit, dude. I was like, you know, I'm just like chilling. He's like, all right, cool. So you can be back in an hour? I'm like, yeah, dude, I'll be here in an hour.
Nice.
And it was definitely, I mean, it was a rough service after not doing it. I mean,
hey, I hope you had slept before you did that. You didn't
I, I got destroyed. I was just like, oh my God, this is terrible. And Chris and both, I mean, thank gosh Neil wasn't there because I don't think. I mean, I got through it, but it wasn't as smooth as when I left.
Yeah,
I wasn't
right.
as used to it. I wasn't definitely used to moving that fast. And both Chris and Scotty were making fun of me all night long. But, I mean, I had a good time. And then I left, and, you know, Chris called me again. He was like, yeah, I mean, we want to offer you a, you know, junior sous. And I think that, you know, Neil definitely was, you know, he wanted it to happen and he wanted to do it. But I think a lot of that came from Scotty and Chris, just, you know, knowing they could depend on me and knowing that I was going to be there.
Sure.
So them wanting to keep me in that kitchen.
That's nice. Now, do you miss New York City? Or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I definitely miss New York. It's you know, it's a different pace, a different lifestyle. And honestly, I mean, yeah, I mean, you get, I mean, I've always said it, but I mean, all the cooks that I was hiring in New York were sous chefs in other areas of the United States.
Right.
And they all had a hard time. I mean, nobody, I never saw anybody walk into New York City and not, and just be like, oh, this is nothing. I mean, I heard a lot of people talk game downstairs when they're just doing prep, and like Mondays and Tuesdays, there was nobody that went through Friday and Saturday.
Yeah,
we're like, oh my God. I was like, yeah, dude, welcome to New York City. Good luck.
I love when cooks come and talk a good game before you even get them in the kitchen.
Yeah.
You know, I spend a little extra time making sure they know who I am when they come in after they talk shit. Maybe if I could get them to cry, that's the best. You know?
I mean, that's one of the places. I mean, in New York, I saw people just break down and cry all the time.
You should have been there taking videos. They would go viral.
Big grown men just... I mean,
yeah.
And it's not like anybody's yelling at them, anybody's screaming at them. It's just like the tickets just keep coming, and they're like, does it stop? And I'm like... Yeah, dude. I was like, everything ends.
Yeah, someday.
Around 11.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, but until then, no. She's like, I'm running out of mise en place. I was like, dude, I told you, man. You didn't work very hard on Monday and Tuesday. I was like, welcome to Wednesday. I was like, we got restaurants week starting tomorrow. We're going to do 280.
Yeah, restaurant week. Everybody loves restaurant week.
I was like, we're going to do 350 for lunch, dude. You going to be ready?
Yeah.
You're not going to be ready. You might want to come in early.
So
I'm not going to pay you, though.
What kind of hours did you work when you were working for any of those guys, whether it was Per Se, Daniel, Oceano?
I mean, at Per Se, you go in at 11 and you're finished at 1:32, depending.
Mm-hmm.
When I worked at Danielle, it was a little less because we would go in at 11 and we'd get done around 11 or 12,
right,
depending on the day. And at Cafe... And Danielle always worked I was a sous chef at Danielle, so we worked 6-5, 6-5, 6-5, 6-5.
Right.
You work 6 days on, and then you work 5 days on, and you work 6 days on. I mean, that depends.
That's
pretty
good.
In the season, that just doesn't happen. I mean, in the winter,
mm-hmm,
you're just there.
Yeah.
You're open, you're there. And just like you said, Oceano's kind of the same thing. I mean, I would get there around 6 o'clock in the morning. I mean, it's all kind of relative. When I first got started, I forgot what happened, but... The A.M. Poissonnier, when I first became a sous chef, the A.M. Poissonnier either quit or got fired at Oceana. I don't remember. But I ended up doing the Poissonnier job in the morning, and I didn't have a guy to do any receiving, so I received everything. And then I'd help set up the line during the day as well. I think Neil decided that was my weight loss program.
That's a good weight loss program.
I think you need some weight loss program. You're going to run up down the stairs. You're going to lose some weight.
How many fish do you think you cut when you were at Oceana?
When I was at Oceana? I mean, we would go through 50 Ludomare a day, about 100 portions. You know, I did it for 3 years, so...
Yeah, that's quite a bit, huh?
Yeah. I mean, that's a day for 50 Ludomare. I'll go through 25 Lu a day, 50 portions. So that's just, you know,
yeah, that's
one
crazy
fish.
Crazy amount of
eight
fish.
Of them. I mean, I don't know, hundreds of halibut, thousands of salmon. I mean, I didn't even keep track of that as well.
Yeah.
And I would teach everybody to work fish, too. They would get so upset with me. I'd come in, I'd be like, all right, like the first 2 days, and I'd help them. I'd fillet everything with them. I'd portion everything with them. I'd, you know, get them all set up, take care of them, make sure that, I mean, basically I just wanted to make sure they didn't get fired. And then, like, the third, like, Friday would come. You know, I'd work with them all through the week, and I'd make sure they were set up. And then Friday would come, and I'd set them up for lunch, and I'd be like, all right, man, see you later. They'd be like, what do you mean? I was like, dude, it's 3 o'clock, man, it's Friday, I'm out. I was like, everybody else is set up. They're like, yeah, I get this ton of fish to do. I'm like, yeah, you sure do. Good luck. You know, I mean, I made sure they didn't, like, need it right away. I mean, I made sure that they were pretty much going to cut us through the day. But, yeah, I mean, he's going to need to get some of that done. And I was like, dude, this is your job.
Yeah.
It's not my job. I helped you all week long. I made sure your Monday double was set. I made sure the rest of the week was set. I was like, now, I mean, this is your job, dude. I'm not going to come and cut fish for you every day.
Yeah.
I was like, you got to learn how to do it. You're kind of slow now, but don't worry. I got fast, you'll get fast. I mean, that was one of the things all the cooks, too, you know, they would sometimes get a little mad at me, be like, I'm like, dude, I did it already.
Yeah.
Whatever. I was like, I opened the station. I'm the first one who started doing it. I was like, dude, I know how to do it. You got to learn how to do it now. Y'all, like, came over when I was cutting fish, and y'all watched me do it, and you're like, that's awesome. I really want to do it. I was like, but when it's yours, you see how much work it is. You're not as excited. I understand. okay.
Well, you know what? You got to be tough to do those positions. If you're gonna cut the fish for a restaurant that's known for fish, you better have your shit together. You know, yeah. You better be ready to
and
rock.
Also,
and roll.
I mean, unlike most of the restaurants I've worked in, I guess I mean Daniel and Per se are the same, but and cafes are the same. But Neil would plate everything.
Really,
the executive chef is standing right in front of you, putting every single piece of fish on the plate. I mean, if it was wrong, you know, you would know right away.
Yeah, sure.
If it was over, if it was under, anything. I mean, you know, anything.
Yeah.
And as the poissonier, you were his direct liaison to, you know, this food's not going out fast enough. We need to go faster. And he would look at the poissonier and be like, Levi, man, pick it up. I'd be like, man, I can't. Veg ain't doing it. Or I'd be like, okay. I'd like tell the veg guy, he's like, okay, you got to get ready now, dude, because we're going to go. Yeah, but I mean, it was definitely... And the way we ran it there, it was literally we were picking up a pick. Like, he would finish plating, and we had to have the next pick in the window. So, like, the next set of tickets in the window. He would plate that, and he was fast. We'd have the next one, and the next one. And you'd have to time it. I mean, you had 8 different fish, and a chicken, and a steak, and you had to time all that together so that the salmon cooked the same time as the mahi, and the same time as the halibut, and the same time as the poached black bass, and the olive oil poached salmon. And have it all up and in the right temperature and still hot and go to him. If it wasn't hot coming out of the oven, he was pissed.
I'll bet. And you know, people that don't work in the kitchen don't realize, but if someone screws up one thing, it could throw
the whole thing.
Could throw the whole night off.
Yeah.
You know. And then the chef is really happy.
Butterfly effect.
Extremely. Extremely.
I mean,
happy.
I don't think I could do it now. I don't think I could go back to Oceana and do that station. It'd be rough. I mean, I'd probably get eventually, but
you'd figure it out. But it was good for you. So tell us about working for Daniel Ballou, and tell us a little bit about him and what if you got anything out of that. And you know,
I got an amazing amount about working with Daniel Ballou. I mean, just the amount of I'd say Daniel Ballou. I mean, for me was like it was like 2 different jobs.
Right.
When I came in, I started working at Daniel as a sous, and then I got promoted to sous chef. I promoted to fish sous chef, which is like, I guess the 3rd sous chef in charge of the kitchen pretty quickly.
Right.
I mean, I learned an amazing amount working with Daniel Ballou. And I did some really stupid things too. It's weird. You always think about like when you think about your time there, you don't always remember all like the positive things that happened, but you remember like the really stupid things you did. I mean, I remember like 2 very specific instances when Daniel was not very happy with me. Yeah.
So what were they? We can tell us about one of them.
Really well. One of them, we were waiting on fava beans to be delivered, and we had some fava beans that weren't the greatest. They just weren't very green anymore. They had kind of been there, I think, for a day or two. And that was, you know, at a restaurant of Daniel's caliber, very unacceptable.
Right.
And Daniel was going through, I don't remember why, but he went down to the mise en place, and he saw them. And I mean, we had just started service. We hadn't sold any dishes, and I very rarely sold halibut, which is what the dish was on.
Right.
And I was, you know, waiting for delivery, and I'd been calling the produce company, I'd gone to the meat cook and been like, man, and so I saw his father, and he had a little bit, but and he sold. His dish really sold, so I was going to steal some if I had to. But then Danielle saw him down there, and he just, I mean, he got very, very upset. Very, very upset.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it was, you know, pretty much, it's all your fault. I mean, you're waiting for a produce guy to come through and you ordered it and you expected it to be there. But at the end of the day, I mean, you're there to make sure that quality and that quality is maintained. And that's as a sous chef, that's your responsibility. So.
If I would have got a fava bean at Danielle that would have had one speck, black speck on it, I would have lost my mind.
You wouldn't even notice. It got covered with like 6 sauces.
I'm just kidding. I had, look.
But
I had my best meal of all time at
Danielle. That was the biggest thing at Danielle. Per se, you know, everything had to be perfect, like Olympic style perfect.
Yeah.
Which is definitely a little bit different than what Danielle does. Because I don't say that every single thing at Danielle has to be, they drove for Olympic style perfect. But,
right.
I mean, when I was there, now they've redone the dining room and they don't have quite as many seats. From my understanding, I mean, actually, I haven't been back, but, that was definitely what we're striving for, Danielle, but I guess how can I describe it? Danielle was a full composed plate.
Right.
That you serve for an entree of a four-course menu
mm-hmm.
with a canapé, an appetizer, an entree, and a dessert.
Right.
There were a lot, many more things that went onto the plate, whereas at Per Se, it was really only three components. So if you honestly messed one of those components up, it was just so visible.
Yeah, true enough.
You know, and people got, you know, yeah, everybody got really angry.
Three
and
components, but how many really courses at Per Se?
Huh?
But at Per Se, it wasn't like first course, second, third, fourth. It was
a
tasting.
It's a nine-course tasting menu.
Right.
Plus extras. Extras, always extra.
Always
extra. Extra VIP stuff.
True enough. I've never gotten a chance to eat there yet, but I've been at Daniel three times. Once at the old spot and twice mm-hmm. in the newer spot. And I actually took Donna there on Valentine's Day once. Sat in the middle table. And it's got the chandelier hanging over it and everything.
Yeah.
And I was amazed by the waiters. You know, so you had like
They're
food.
Incredible.
The food runners would run everything up to the upper area and set it down, and then the back waiter would bring you the food, and the front waiter was moving around, and the captains were everywhere. It was one of the most beautifully orchestrated restaurants I'd ever seen. And I forgot my reading glasses. And I was looking at the tasting menu for Valentine's Day, and I couldn't read it. And I said, oh, damn, I left my glasses at the room. And within 5 seconds, the captain was there with a box of reading glasses. And he's like,
mm-hmm.
Which strength do you like, sir? And I'm just like, wow, that's, you know, those little things, you know, that make you realize that, you know, you better, if you want to be a good chef or a great chef and you want to have a really nice restaurant, you got to have all those details working so well.
Yeah.
You know, just eating there was a lesson for me. I imagine working there, especially working there in a position of responsibility. I mean, not just staging and being downstairs prepping, but being on the line and being in charge of a section and stuff, that had to be something that really, you know, influenced you in a way.
It was a huge responsibility. I mean, it was a huge dedication. And then, I mean, then at the same time, I felt really honored when they came to me and they're like, do you want to move not only to another restaurant, but another restaurant that is pretty much regarded as one step down or in a different way equal to Restaurant Danielle, and you want to be the second in command of that restaurant.
Right. How long did you do that at Cafe Ballou?
I was there for a year and change.
Mm-hmm. And how did you decide to leave there? Did you go from there to Per Se?
No, I went from Per Se. I went from Oceana, and then I left there and I went to Per Se. And then I got a phone call from actually a friend of mine, Melissa, who I worked with at Oceana.
Right.
And she said that JFK would like to talk to me. So I went from Per Se, I went over to Danielle.
Mm-hmm.
And then from Danielle, I was asked if I wanted to go to a cafe.
Cool. And because I used to talk to you and I used to say, when are you going to get a chef job? And you said, I'm not ready yet, you know. So.
Yeah, I really didn't feel, I mean, that was one of my biggest goals was that I just didn't want to jump into something.
Sure.
Before I really thought I was ready. I really wanted to go and I really wanted to go work in places and feel like what I'm going to tell people and what, you know, the knowledge I'm going to give to people is really going to be something that's going to be worth something that's worthwhile. And I really wanted to, I mean, I guess my goal was, in the end of the day, was really to learn how to cook. Not just to kind of understand it, but really know how to cook.
Right.
And I see so many kids that come into culinary school, they're like, I'm chefs. I'm like, dude, no, you're not. I was like, no, you're not.
You're a high-priced beginner. That's what I used to tell them. That was my favorite thing. Oh, you're from culinary. You're a high-priced beginner. And that was, I remember a guy told me he needed respect because he went to the Culinary Institute. I said, really? Give you some respect. Yeah. So I remember spitting his soup out one time and he almost started crying. But hey, so you worked for, you know, Thomas Keller. Now, I know I'm not sure how much he was at Per Se, but what was that experience like?
The experience was great. I mean, TK was there, I guess, 2 weeks out of the month, every single month.
Right.
I didn't have an amazing amount of contact with him, but, I mean, I had enough. I mean, Jonathan was incredible, and now the chef de cuisine who is there now, Eli Kemp, was one of the sous chefs when I was there. So, I mean, yeah, it was an amazing experience to go there and to see what they do and to see how they do it and to see their techniques and to see their precision. I mean, I think just their precision is, their execution is, it's pretty much as flawless as you can get and consistently as flawless as you can get.
That's awesome.
And controlled. I mean, I would say that's the largest difference between Danielle and Thomas for me. Is, I mean, the level of control that Thomas has is pretty awe-inspiring. I mean, they only do 100 people.
Right.
They will only ever do 100 people. There will be no more. If there's a banquet, it will be pulled out of another room by another team.
Right.
You know, and Danielle's not as controlled to a certain extent. I mean, you do 350, you do 200. But at the same time, Danielle is, his style is more, you know, there are so many things that I saw there that because, you know, he would come into the kitchen and just be like, we're going to do this for this person. They're a VIP. They're a friend of mine. I want to make this dish. And then we would just do it. You know, I mean, they had such a team and such a resource there that they could pull off those amazing, incredible things that were, as you said, with the reading glasses that were tailored to an individual. I mean, he was just at a table and they said that, this guy said, you know, what I really love is to have some mac and cheese like my grandmother would make. And Daniel would be like, oh, yes, we make mac and cheese. And then we would come back. And that's an offshoot in the wild. I don't think we ever made mac and cheese. But, you know, that would be one of those things. Or, you know, he just found fresh pea balls, or he was just in this place and he found this ingredient and he wants to try it like this. And, you know, he has a VIP regular, or one of the owners would come in. Or, I mean, there was just always, Danielle was such a big restaurant. And there was always so many different facets of things going on in that restaurant. I mean, it never stopped, and it never slept to a certain extent.
Yeah, right.
I mean, between prep downstairs and Mark the baker and the pastry kitchen that also did stuff for other things, then Mark would send his bread out to the other five restaurants. And then the huge prep team that took care of prep for Danielle and prep for Feast and Fete, which are their off-site catering,
right,
was also located at the restaurant. There were so many different facets of that place.
That's craziness, actually. So now you're in. I'm just going to go real quick because we're going to finish up. But you went down to Washington and you opened up the old Jockey Club, which at one time was the greatest restaurant in Washington D.C. with Chef Marcel Vanicole.
Now I think it's Club 21.
So they changed it to Club 21 now.
Yeah, they changed it. Changed the name. They changed the whole concept. Apparently.
Yeah, you know, it's a shame because the right company, I think, would have opened it and done the right thing. It could have been back, but I just don't think that was the right company to do it. And I know that you realized that too. So you went to work a little bit with Michel Richard, another highly respected chef in America, and opened the restaurant at Tyson's Corner. What did he call that? Michel?
He opened restaurant Michel in the Ritz-Carlton in Tyson's Corner.
And how was that opening? Huh? That was something, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it was fun. It was a good time. I don't think that me and Michelle necessarily saw eye to eye on everything that we wanted to do and how we wanted to do it, as far as, I don't think we had the same style.
Right.
That was, I think, our biggest problem is we weren't really the same stylistically.
Sure.
That really didn't work out. But now he has a great chef named John Matheson, who I actually just saw in L.A. Food & Wine, I guess last weekend. He was down and Michel Richard was down.
Sure.
So yeah, I mean, it was a crazy opening because it's a three meal a day restaurant. So right after we got done doing dinner, we went right into, I opened breakfast first.
Right.
And then 2 days later we opened dinner, and then like 2 weeks after that we opened lunch. So it was, you know, and that was right in the middle of winter. We're out there, which is like kind of right in the middle of the season.
Sure.
So, I mean, it was a whirlwind opening, you know, going in, taking a month and buying all the equipment and setting up the kitchen and hiring an entire staff and putting the whole thing together. I mean, for me, being the first time I'd done that with other people to a certain extent, but I'd never really done it, you know, as the chef.
Right.
You know, and then kind of designing the menu to a certain extent. I mean, Michelle designed the menu, but then just getting the menu for Michelle and trying to understand his food and how everything works and how he cooks everything, and spending time in Citronelle and then spending time in Central. It was a whirlwind opening. It was an amazing experience. I wouldn't trade it for anything, but it was quick.
Yeah.
It was a quick, fast.
Well, you know,
opening,
openings are tough, man. I mean,
all the time.
I think every, every young chef, every maitre d', every sommelier, everybody should do an opening or two, really high quality opening, because it's mentally challenging and physically challenging. But at the end of the day,
for me, I enjoy it so much. I decided I just should do it again. within a year, I've opened two restaurants.
So tell
us. One for Michelle Richard, and now I've opened one for Coastal Luxury Management for Rob Weekly and Dave Bernal with Tobias Peach. We just opened Restaurant 1833, which is in the oldest Stokes, Dobe, or Gallatin's restaurant in the middle of downtown Monterey.
I hear it's beautiful down there. You know, one of these days I wanna visit. So you're out there with the guys that started Pebble Beach Food and Wine.
And now this year, L.A. Food and Wine.
Is that the first year they've done L.A. Food and Wine?
Yeah, it was the first year we did L.A. Food and Wine.
And that was, what, last week, right?
Yeah. It was a great time.
How's everybody after that?
I mean, honestly, I just saw everybody last night. They were all in the restaurant, hanging out, eating. We changed more than half of the menu at this point, again, just with new dishes that are coming in. I mean, fall's coming into season, so, of course, the squashes and everything. They're great. Sure. I mean, they look a little tired.
Yeah, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely, they're happy. Everything got cleaned up. It was an amazing event. It really was. Saturday was incredibly crazy busy. A lot of the big events got sold out. It was a lot of fun.
Sure. But that'll be for another interview. We'll talk about those events, because I'd love to, hear from them, too. But so now you got your first kitchen. What kind of influence are the owners with you? Are they letting you kind of do your thing, or are they pretty strong on you for what they'd like to see?
I'd say they kind of set the idea in motion. They gave me a couple other restaurants that they looked at and they went to say, they don't want anything amazing or incredibly fine dining.
Right.
And I think in today's climate, that's kind of what everybody's going for.
Sure.
There's not many people that are opening, 3-star Michelin, 4-star New York Times restaurants, because, people aren't really going out to those restaurants as much as they used to.
Right.
The ones that are successful are still very, very successful. But, they wanted to do more of a more casual restaurant, but with great, great food and great dining. I guess the influence that I get from them mainly is, they just come in and eat the food.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't really say, they never go, this dish sucks. But they'll say, maybe a little more salt, or what do you think about this? Or, they don't do it in an overbearing way.
Sure.
More of a, it's your restaurant, you run with it, you have fun. We don't, between our festivals and all the other things that we do, we don't have time, nor do we have the desire to micromanage.
Yeah, right.
That's why we went and sought, you guys out. I mean, we have an amazing team. Ted Glennon, our wine director, comes from some pretty impressive restaurants. Tobias Peach worked at Fleur de Lis in Vegas and Boulay in New York City. And William was one of the main guys who opened restaurants for Wolfgang Puck for years. And he worked at Spago, and he was in Vegas for a while. My friend Nikolai, who came out with me, I took from John George.
Right.
So, and he works with me at Oceana.
Sounds like a pretty cool team.
Yeah, it's a great team. It really is a great team. I couldn't pick a better group of people to work with. I mean, honestly, on a day-to-day basis, everybody, pretty much surprises and almost impresses everybody else.
Yeah, I think what's pretty neat about your journey is that now you're sitting out in Monterey. You probably didn't even think that last year you're going to be sitting in Monterey.
Last year, no, not at all. I mean, as far as, New York, I knew that was going to end after a time because my wife didn't want to stay in New York City. And after our son was born, it was kind of time.
Mm-hmm.
But no, from there, I had no idea I would be. I didn't think I would go from almost within a year, I would go from New York City to one restaurant in D.C. to another restaurant in D.C. and then out here into Monterey, California. It was a little quick, and that's not always what people are looking for when they hire a person, but I'm thankful that Rob and Dave gave me the chance. And it's a great location. It's a great place. And they're really free to, to expand not only the concept, but the company. So, pretty much in this edition, the sky's the limit.
Yeah, true enough.
And also to have, two amazing events like LA Food and Wine and Pebble Beach Food and Wine. That's kind of like bookends to my year. To be a part of those events is, amazing to see how they come together and the inner workings.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's awesome.
It's an amazing company to work for.
That's awesome. And you get to rub elbows with a bunch of other chefs and people. But, you know, I think you paid your dues and you deserve a good job like that. And, you know, somewhere along the line, you'll have your own place with partners like them anyway. And, this is a cool story. I'm proud of you. And
thank you.
One of these days, you know, I'm going to get out there and taste some of your food.
And, yeah, maybe we can do some. I don't know. I might be to get you involved in Pebble.
That would
one
be
day.
A lot of
have
fun.
Have you do some barbecue at Pebble?
There you
we
go.
A whole big barbecue this year.
That would be cool. Awesome. Yeah, we do. We'd show people how to make barbecue. How a fine dining chef works his way into barbecue. Because I'll tell you what, the barbecue people from the East Coast, they're not into fine dining chefs rolling into barbecue. So. They weren't real comfortable, but they still don't really like me all that much, but we're doing some really good stuff. But, look, Levi, thanks so much. And, I sure appreciate it. And, folks, you've been listening to Chew the Fat. Listen to us every, Sunday night, is when our new, podcasts come out. You can find us on SevillePodcast.com. That's SevillePodcast.com. And also on our blog, ChewFat.net. We have right now over 70 hours of in-depth interviews with chefs and other food personalities. And, make sure you sound out. Let us know what you think. If you have anybody that, you want us to talk to. And, yeah. With that, adios.
This song is called Alice's Restaurant. It's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant was never the name of a restaurant. That was always just the name of this song. And I guess that, well, that's probably why I still call this song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything.